And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me today. As with all of our guests, could you introduce yourself, please?
Absolutely. So first, thank you for having me. My name is Megan Lalonde. I am an assistant professor of midwifery at Mount Royal University, which is located in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. And I teach in the midwifery program, and I'm also a registered midwife and maintain a part-time clinical practice. And then my other gig is as a doctoral student at the University of Central Lancashire, which is located in Preston, in the United Kingdom.
So that's covering kind of like different parts of the top of the world, really.
Yes, yeah.
You've got Canada and England as well. So why did you choose to do your PhD through Lancashire? What was attractive about doing it through there and not doing it in a more local university?
Well, we don't actually have any graduate programs in Canada for midwifery.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was obligated to go out of country for that. And of course, when you're looking at overseas education, practicalities make a difference. So, you know, ease of access and cost are two huge factors. But the third one is that University of Central Lancashire offers some really excellent supervisors for their graduate programs. So I, when I decided I wanted to do a master's degree, I started looking around. I looked at universities in Australia, in New Zealand, and in the UK primarily. So although I speak English and French fluently, I wanted to do my studies in English, so I was looking somewhere in the Commonwealth, university programs that would be recognized in Canada, and then that I could do either low residency or by distance, so that I'd be able to continue working while I was completing graduate studies. And University of Central Lancashire fit the bill. They had excellent courses, easy to access, it was affordable, and I had a fabulous supervisor for my master's degree who has also become my supervisor for my doctorate.
Having the ability to do it distance in 2020 with COVID would have been a huge advantage as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It has been. I did travel twice to the UK for intensives, once during my master's and then in the first year of my doctorate. Every year they do a graduate seminar where you meet with other students from your school and you present where you're at in your research, and there's you know, workshops and opportunity to meet other colleagues there. So I did that last year. And then of course this year we had to move to a virtual format for that, which was really well done. I really appreciate how much work it is, having spent the last year teaching virtually. It's a lot of work to run that kind of seminar for people who are all over in different time zones.
And that's like 2020 has given us an amazing amount of learning curves. And I think understanding our own resilience as well, that we were put under in various different ways, be it clinical, be it academically, be it just surviving the day personally, that we're a lot stronger, a lot of us, than what we thought we were. And not that we want to go more into that, but 2021 is going to still be a bit to beat. So what topic are you doing your PhD on then?
So essentially I'm looking at the epistemology of record keeping.
Oh.
So I want to look at how standardized, or I am looking at how standardized documentation shapes narratives of the sexual and reproductive body.
Nice. What got you into that?
Actually, it started when I, a few years into practice, I had just relocated to Alberta. I'd been practicing out of province, and I came back and I was working at a birth center. We did lots of out of hospital birth. And one of the things that I noticed is that there really was nowhere on our standardized forms to document water birth. So we use documentation that's standard across the province. It's issued by the government. All maternity care providers use the same ones. But there wasn't anywhere to record that. So it would show up in our narrative notes, but not on official documentation. And the reality was, even though we were doing lots of water birth, still in the broader obstetrical community, it was not a well-accepted practice. There was still lots of fear around sort of this, you know, aspiration pneumonia in the newborn, that they might drown, fears like that. And I think part of the context that's important is that, unlike other Commonwealth countries, we really lost midwifery in Canada for a long time. And it wasn't regulated until 1994 in the province of Ontario, and actually in 1998 in Alberta. So, you know, when I was practicing as a new midwife, we hadn't even been regulated for 20 years. And so we currently, I can tell you, provide care in about 7.5% of the births which take place in our province. And the remainder of care is provided by obstetricians and obstetrical nurses. So we're a small profession. Water birth wasn't well regarded. And there was sort of a sense that, you know, you didn't necessarily want everyone to know that you were doing it. Like, there was a bit of a, just a feeling that you knew you were doing something that, you know, it might be frowned upon. Even though, you know, it's done all over the world and it's done safely and there's research and all of that, that's just not the sort of milieu that you're in. But shortly after I started practicing here, the sort of directive came to start recording water birth on our official forms, because someone had decided to do a research study and they wanted to use our perinatal health system. So it's kind of like our surveillance system that collects data on outcomes. They wanted to use that data set to look at outcomes from water birth as a way to have data that was in our context and that could be used to support the practice. So we started just freehand writing it in on our forms. And I thought this was really interesting because it struck me that it was like a dialogue, right? Where we were speaking to the people who were collecting the data, and there was this imagination. There was, you know, there's these people who are going to read it and they're going to do something with that data. And of course, now it's been, I think that project's been ongoing for 5 or 6 years. But the data is complete, and it's now become a field on our standardized forms for water birth. Yes, and we actually just issued our first province-wide policy guideline for water birth.
So what's the percentage of water births then after that kind of time period?
That's a good question. I don't actually have precise data on how many are being completed. I think fewer than historically, but that's because we've seen a shift from out of hospital to more in hospital birth. When I first started practicing, I really did 80% out of hospital birth, and over time that's really shifted and certainly fallen below 50%. And until we had this guideline, it wasn't possible to do water birth in every hospital. So having a guideline is that tool that allows us to offer that in a hospital setting. So I suspect we'll see the trend change in the next few years.
So how strict are those guidelines now? Is it all looking at low risk and low BMI and that kind of the same criteria as for home birth almost?
We worked really hard to keep the guideline at the practitioner's discretion and to really emphasize informed choice for the client. But essentially, any kind of risk factor that would necessitate things like continuous monitoring or would recommend continuous monitoring, I should say, rather than necessitate, recommend that would be an opportunity to reconsider water birth. So there definitely is concern around those kinds of risk factors that we see go along with home birth.
Mm-hmm. So before I get back to your PhD, you made a comment that the birthing has changed to much more obstetric. And I know that in a lot of the American states, it's very much a medical obstetric model as well. And the midwifery practice is taking kind of, once again, small kind of percentage of the load. What is the shift from going from kind of home birthing or outside the hospital to moving back into the hospital now? Is that increasing comorbidities or is it insurance? Or what do you think the trend's related to?
I would actually say it's client choice. So as we've seen our midwifery workforce grow, and we've been able to serve a greater population of women, I think that fewer are choosing midwifery care because they want out of hospital birth.
Right.
So when I first started practicing, I practiced in Edmonton, Alberta for a long time, and I don't have the exact numbers, but I think there may have been 7 midwives when I started practicing for a city of just under 1 million people at the time.
Wow.
And so your client base is very small and it's people who really are seeking out an alternative to mainstream obstetrical care, which typically comes with someone who wants to have an out-of-hospital birth. No. Combined with the fact that as midwives, we didn't obtain hospital privileging for some time, even after regulation. So I think now that we have more midwives and that hospital privileging is routinized, it's a matter of people who are seeking midwifery care may not be seeking it because we offer out-of-hospital birth.
Right. Cool.
They might be seeking it for continuity of care, is a big draw because we do case loading here. We do continuity of care in Canada. So I think that's a huge draw.
And we know from the evidence, from multiple site evidence and multiple country evidence, that continuity of care is the key. It's cheaper, it's better, there are more straightforward vaginal births, women are happier, there's less PTSD. And that continuity of care, and especially midwifery care, has been shown to be the gold standard through major powered research. So how does this all link then to what you're looking at then for your PhD?
Mm-hmm. Well, so this, the whole issue of water birth for me, it made it really interesting how the forms that we use shape how we provide care and how they shape possibilities in birth, and how I wanted to know how midwives in particular chose to complete those forms. So, for example, when a standardized form says, you know, what was the start of the first stage of labor? What is the start of the second stage of labor? It suggests, again, that there's a distinction in that physiological process. And of course, I was curious, how do we determine that? Hmm. Because, you know, from my own experience, we often don't do vaginal exams to ensure that someone a cervix is fully dilated. We might go based on someone's behavior. We might, you know, if they feel like pushing, we might say, yeah, absolutely go for it. And then see what happens. So of course, you know, in practice, you know that, and I know it's not just midwives, we know it's everyone working in obstetrics. How do you determine and, you know, what is what and what is happening when? And then how do you complete those forms? And I think just that until that field is completed on a standardized form, it's almost like that doesn't come into being, that part of that physiological process or childbearing doesn't actually exist. And so I wanted to look at how midwives use those forms, both in ways that are resistive to the dominant narrative, in ways that conform to it. I wanted to know if they do one thing in practice, but complete forms in a certain way because they know that that's being surveilled somehow, whether that's for medical legal purposes, whether it's by the health authority. I wanted to know about that because I think it has huge implications, particularly as we move into electronic charting and sort of the way electronic charting entrenches even more so that narrative and sometimes limits possibilities of recording. So, you know, we see all kinds of things with electronic records where you can't move forward to other fields until you've completed the field you're in. And so whereas that's different from a paper chart where you have the option to leave that blank, you have the option to write something in, that doesn't exist. And so coming from a point of equipoise, I hope, what does it do when our capacity to write that narrative becomes even more rigid or limited? And that has huge implications going forward, particularly because electronic records, there's lots of talk about using them as data sets for research. And so I think it's really important going forward that we don't assume that these tools are value neutral.
Is there a risk that we lose the context?
Yes.
Electronic records, because it does become a tick and a flick and you can't expand, whereas on paper notes you can. You can write on a partogram, you can kind of add a side comment, whereas, you're not going to have that potential to do that with electronics.
Exactly. Yeah, on a paper record, you can write water birth in the comments field, or you can cross something out, or you can write declined an exam. I don't know when second stage started, they declined, or it was when the baby came out. I think there's the potential to lose that flexibility. And if it doesn't appear in the form, it doesn't exist in the official narrative.
Yeah. So where have you got up to so far with your studies?
So I've completed my coursework. I just got my ethics approval.
Yay, that's amazing. So where are you going to be collecting? Is it going to be both sides of the waters? Are you going to do both UK and Canada or just Canada?
Just Canada. So I'm going to look at midwives in Alberta specifically. I want to look at not only how they complete our current records, but I'm hoping, if possible, to interview some of the few midwives who practiced prior to regulation, who often designed their own forms.
Oh, nice.
For you. Yeah, because I'd like to know, you know, I've certainly seen lots of practices still use their own partogram. And I want to ask them, you know, why did you design this the way that you did? What information did you choose to include? Why not use the partogram that's provided for us? And to just see, because I think it speaks to underlying ideology of childbearing.
And that would be really quite fascinating, because when you do audits and you go back on paperwork, there's always missing elements that haven't been completed, which if you're trying to do it for a case study is the bane of your life. But it will be interesting to see what commonalities were missed out or what was deemed relevant or irrelevant.
Yes.
And then how, and the same, who's made the decisions to include it in the electronic records? So who made those decisions and what were the reasons? I keep thinking of the research that I've read on respiratory, counting respiratory rates, and how it's the most fraudulently written observation that it's never counted. It's like, they're going, okay, they're 16. And there's so many people who are 16 or 18, but it's actually never counted, when we know that it's one of the first signs of the body starting to compensate is that changing of that respiratory pattern. But it's still written down and people go, oh, we'll just tick and flick it because it's part of it. So, yeah, understanding what's included and the reasoning for something not being included would be quite interesting to see that historical journey through.
Yes, absolutely. How did we decide it was important? How does someone decide that they've met the criteria to chart it? I often wonder when I look at my own documentation that often time of starting to push and second stage are synonymous.
Mm.
And I know it's because it's not always my practice to offer a vaginal exam.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if you did a chart audit or you looked at the data, how often does that occur? And what is the time difference between those two phases? If you were to look at across the board charting, is there a huge difference? Because I know it speaks to a particular style of practice. And a style of practice or what a person might want in labor, what they might decline or they might accept, all of that affects that. But that also, if we use that as a basis for research or to understand physiology, that makes a big difference.
Yep, certainly does.
Mm-hmm.
So how many women, or how many midwives, I should say, instead of women, how many midwives are you expecting or you're hoping to be able to interview or talk to?
I have no idea. We'll see.
Whoever will talk to me.
Yes, I'd be happy with 5. I mean, 10, I think, would be loads of data. I'd be happy with even more, but we'll see in the new year, you know, who feels like they have time and interest in talking about, you know, standardized documentation tools, which, you know, I think they're pretty interesting, but I don't know if they're a big sell.
We had, in Australia, we had some standardised observation charts come in that were based on, our Royal Life Saving that swim between the flags. Mm-hmm. So they're coloured charts that are for both general population but also for maternity as well. And so you've got your supposed healthy range and then you've got 3 different colours. The first colour you go into is kind of like talk to your TL. Second colour is kind of get the doctor. And the third is call a MET call, kind of medical emergency team call. And it's really interesting of when that kind of came in, because it was very much standardised and had set actions for different colours going into it. And I think this is something that people have been talking about with electronics as well. The concern is it stops that critical thinking. Is that individual critical thinking of, oh, I'm in that flag, I've got to do this. And it's like, yeah, but what else is that actually telling you about that person at that time? And forgetting that it's actually looking at trends. It's not looking at one individual number and putting it together. So do you feel that's a problem too with the electronic records, if they become too tick and flick, that we don't have that capacity for that narrative, that individual contextualization, if that makes sense?
Absolutely. I think there's a few things there. The first thing is that there's not a lot of research showing that electronic records are actually safe. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that stands out to me is the shift to, paperless fetal heart rate monitoring. We've really gone to, you know, we used to have, of course, you remember the great long tracings, the big strips of paper. And now we've gone to paperless, which means that you're only able to see segments of the fetal heart rate at one time. And you actually have to scroll, you know, across the screen to view the heart rate over time. And that's never been shown to be a safe way to do fetal heart rate interpretation. And of course, you know, putting aside all of the issues there actually is with fetal, you know, continuous electronic fetal monitoring, we know that, you know, the research doesn't really support it for improving outcomes. And yet it plays such a huge role, you know, in lawsuits, in chart review, massive. And so now we've gone to this system of viewing it that makes it even more difficult to watch over time changes in the heart rate. So that stands out right away. And then I think the other thing, you know, having worked with more and more different electronic charting systems, really the structure can make it very difficult to look at trends over time. Just depending, you know, with a paper record, you can open it up. It's right there in front of you. But with an electronic chart, is often you have to choose to look at a screen. You have to choose a particular display. You don't get the same sense often over time of what's happening with that person. And so I do think that there's some significant issues. It doesn't mean they can't be rectified. You know, I don't want to come out as like a Luddite, you know, against electronic charting. That's not it. But I think that there's some really fundamental issues that I don't know how well they're being addressed. Let's put it that way. Mm-hmm.
I think we had a coroner's case here for a non-maternity situation, but the coroner got a printout because we had electronic records for in that hospital. And the observations came out printed, one set of observations per page. So not in a graphic chart. And the coroner just sat there and said, I'm not reading this. This is ridiculous. This means nothing to me. I need to kind of, and so that was, there was no way that that system was able to put it into a graphic to actually show those trends, because putting it one page completely missed the picture. And so, yeah, it's fixable. It just needs people to understand why it's needed, which goes back to that, what gets put in, what gets left out, and who makes those decisions.
Exactly, exactly. So I think really huge issues going forward with electronic charting. That's super interesting, but also as we all sort of race towards widespread implementation, it needs to be looked at. And I think we need to move forward with using these systems cautiously, because they're not really proven yet.
No, and when you've got places using different versions of different products and different softwares that don't speak to each other either, that's an issue. And then when you've got hybrids that some are using it and some areas are not using it, and then healthcare has always been very messy. Some countries and provinces do it easier and have an all or nothing outlook, which is what you kind of need. But when you've got multiple different systems and doing different things, and you've got increasing of the error of recording and missing of information.
Absolutely. Just the utility. I did some testing of a large system that will be implemented here. It was interesting, you know, they asked for volunteers to just come and use the system with no training, and then they watch to see how intuitive is it? Are you able to figure out how to use the system? So it was a super interesting experience. But one of the things I noticed is that you have to enter orders for postpartum care for what we would consider routine, like taking a blood pressure, you know, doing a fundal check. So you have to enter them as orders. So the first thing that's super interesting to that to me is the medicalization, yep. Right? That routine care would actually become a formal order. But the second thing is you have to enter those orders in order to access the postpartum charting flow sheet.
Yep.
And so I'm thinking, gosh, you know, if you were having a complication in the middle of a postpartum hemorrhage, no one's going to have time to be sitting, entering orders, entering their electronic signature in order to open up your documentation. And so, of course, we know what will happen. It's the paper towel,
yep.
Charting, where we write on a paper towel because we can't use the system quickly enough, and then you've created a double chart. And essentially, you've missed the whole point of electronic charting. Mm. You're not actually using it, right? It's being used at a later time to record events in a non-contemporaneous fashion.
And that's where, yeah, the design of it is interesting, because a lot of the design is on a very normal day, but it's not the emergency situation. If you design something that works in an emergency situation, it'll by default work in a normal day-to-day situation. Mm-hmm. But that, yeah, that's a really interesting kind of concept to think about. That
yeah.
We'll revert to writing on the back of our hands, on our gowns, on paper towels.
On our scrub pants.
Absolutely, because it's like, yeah. It's there instantly. You've got to, if you've got someone who's having PE and their blood pressure's going through the roof, you're just going to write it down, because all you're doing is looking at that and her arm and doing your blood pressures, and you're just kind of writing it down. You're not trying to get in the computer, and then you've got your gloves on so you can't do your linking, or you forget somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all sit there and kind of go, no, take me away. I don't want that kind of like technology.
I know, it's true. I was like, no, the paper record's fine.
But it covers. You can take it anywhere. You don't have power blackouts. Like, you're safe. You can go anywhere. But, yeah. But maybe that's it. We still need that hybrid system. We still need to work a way that we've got the security on the system, but we have the flexibility as well.
Yes. Yeah. So there's interesting questions. And I think even, you know, that's an example of where normalcy becomes the default for the system, and it doesn't function in an abnormal system. which is, you know, it's also just sort of an interesting, what's the expectation of postpartum and what's the expectation of normal care? And, you know, when do you vary from that? If you enter orders for, you know, vital signs to be done at a certain, certain intervals, then what happens when you have to vary that? Where's the clinical judgment, right?
Yeah, yeah. And also when you're thinking, I know that we have linking to our care plans are very much linked to our staffing levels as well. And so it's interesting in some areas they'll go, put in everything you're doing, which is what we should be doing to get accurate. But then they go, no, but we don't need to include that, that, and that. And it's like, but that's what is needed. And that's to say this is the workload that's needed. Oh, yeah, but no, we don't include that. But you're short-shifting yourself because you're actually not staffing yourself to the work that needs to be done.
Well, and that's, I think, another interesting aspect to the electronic charting is that it has so many different functions. You know, it's not just for documentation. You know, it can also be used for medical legal purposes. It can also be used for communication with a colleague. It sometimes becomes the record of someone's experience. I mean, how many times have I've been asked for my own notes for someone's experience to, quote, know what happened during their birth, right? So that record also becomes part of someone's own internal experience of something. And then, of course, it's also used for billing purposes, for work, for workload, you know, for understanding what tasks care providers are carrying out. So that's the other thing that we have to really think about in this tool is that it has so many different functions. What ones, you know, which does it work better for certain functions than others? How does that integration of functions influence the information we draw out of it, the structure of it, all of those things? It's an enormous topic.
That's why you're doing a PhD on it. And a portion of it. But that does bring it in because you're bringing in systems managements, you're bringing in project managements, you're bringing in all of those other kind of business analytics that are needed as well. So it's like you've got a committee that's needed to design a form because it's not just the midwives. Like, this is what we need and this is why we need it. Then you've got kind of like seven other people going, well, this is what we need and this is why we need it. And then you've got, well, this is now a 100-page document, which is kind of like impractical. How do we cull that down to something that can be filled in by the people who are doing it and still be used in the back end?
Yes. It's an enormous task, really.
It is.
And I just think it has huge implications for how we provide care.
The more and more we go electronically, absolutely, because we're going to miss those nuances.
We miss the nuance, I think, of the person receiving care. And I also think that in some ways we miss the nuance of the care provider.
Yeah.
It's about that increasing standardization of medicine. And I think it's interesting to see maternity care, which sometimes needs medicine, but there's also another component that isn't medical about maternity care. So how does that get taken up by that process of standardization where there's a limited number of possibilities, right? Your diagnosis is limited. It's a checklist. Or it has to be linked to certain symptoms, or you get the drop-down menu that tells you what's possible for that person, that diagnosis, and that, you know, I wonder how that changes innovation. How does it change variation in the way an illness presents or the way just basic physiology presents? If that's not a possibility offered by the form, is it a possibility that we know exists?
And because people are people, they're not case studies. They're not going to be exactly the same as what is in a textbook. And we know that people are their own experts at how whatever's happening to their body is affecting them. And the key to relationship, and I need to remember who said this quote, and I can't remember who said it, but it was every pregnant woman needs a midwife, some need a doctor.
Yes, I hear that often. I think it's from the UK. I don't know.
I think it's Professor Jane Sandow. I don't know. I need to follow that up and kind of write that down. Because it is, when you're speaking about pregnancy, that every woman should have a midwife to be there, because we know the relationship care. We know that kind of information is important.
And then it's a whole psychosocial and cultural process, even though there may be elements of it that do require medical care. Mm-hmm. That's not, you know, there's other implications and importance. Mm-hmm.
And it does. It takes a village to kind of sometimes to keep the pregnancy going as well as to bring up a child. And that's when we do work together, and we're so used to working together. It's just depending on who we're working together with. So you've got your normal job. So how have you gone in 2020 with converting all of your teaching to online? Because that takes a, having done the same thing myself, I know my headspace is just, I'm still kind of sitting completely drained with everything that's happened this year, and then trying to fit in PhD as well. So how have you struggled with that work demand of increasing workload, trying to balance that with the study and still kind of not necessarily always be sitting rocking in the corner?
Well, how has the online conversion gone? You probably have to ask my students, because I might say, you know, I think it went pretty well. They might feel differently, which would be fair. And honestly, with the workload, this year I took on a role as the interim coordinator for our program. So I had to laugh. My first time coordinating a whole midwifery program in a pandemic was not a small feat. And so in all honesty, my doctoral work's taken a back burner. It's just been really challenging to find the time to really get in depth with it, because it's not the off the side of your desk, a little bit here, a little bit there. It really requires lots of deep focus. And, you know, I picked a really interesting practical topic, but it's also heavily theoretical. Mm. And so creating that foundation of theory, it has just been, it's been challenging. It's not an easy read. I'm cursing myself a bit for choosing Foucault as one of my theorists.
All right. Okay. Yeah. No, he's not heavy. He's not easy. And especially in the middle of a pandemic, because yes. And that is, it's that one of the things I talk about with different people as well is that balance, because a lot of the midwives who do postgraduate studies are coming from a more mature place, as in they're not coming straight from undergraduate, straight to honours, straight to PhD. That all of the ones that I've spoken to and most that I know have had clinical experience, have been out for a few years and then have kind of come back into it. So you've got to juggle. You've got to juggle family, which we know, but you've got to juggle that clinical or that kind of like working as well. And so when you look at the average PhD student, which is a male in the early 20s that has kind of come through a science topic and going straight through, midwifery blows that we're kind of going to be older females that are starting their studies. So it's little tips and tricks on how to balance, how to keep your sanity, because we know postgraduate studies are big mental health issues if you're not careful, because of just, well, not even in a pandemic situation. So how do you balancing that? How are you keeping yourself kind of like okay, even though it's okay not to be okay?
I mean, that's a good question. I feel pretty fortunate working clinically. So I do work clinically in addition to teaching full time, is a lot, but that also has been a bit of what's, I think, kept me going and was a really important aspect of socialization when we were sort of in lockdown, that was really important to be able to go out and go to births and see colleagues there. So I really enjoyed that. I do a lot of physical activity. Is really, that's my hobby and how I think I keep sane, I guess. Mm-hmm. I really miss the swimming pool. I'm a big swimmer. And of course, we haven't had access to that for huge portions of the year. So I've compensated. I box several times a week. And really enjoy that, and weightlift. So that's what has kept me going. And then as for getting studies done, I've tried really hard to block off time every week, even if it's a few hours to work on it. It doesn't always happen, but I think having that dedicated time, and I just send emails to my supervisors whenever I finish something or I sort of want to be accountable or touch bases, and that also is really helpful. And then connections like this, I have to say, actually, I've made a number of connections with academic midwives through Twitter.
Yep.
And that's been a really great community over the last year, actually.
And hopefully that's something that's going to keep on growing now that we've kind of got the basis of it.
I hope so. Yeah. Especially being in a country where we don't have a single graduate program for midwives, it's pretty isolating.
That's just that really did shock me. That kind of, because I keep thinking, and this is not meant to sound disrespectful, but I thought Canada was a lot more advanced in that kind of context, and which I know nursing, and I'm doing research with some Canadian universities as well in simulation. But it's, yeah, that really was quite shocking, because I would have thought that you'd had some graduate programs.
No, it's a bit of a paradox. So, you know, we practice essentially what is considered, you know, the gold standard. We do continuity of care, really all across the country. Other models are really difficult to find. We practice in all settings, you know, so you could practice at home, at birth centers, in the hospital. Mm. All of that is, I think, really, we've done a good job that way. But it's still just a very small, young profession. And so there's definitely some gaps. And, you know, I know lots of essentially midwifery professors, many of us are doing graduate programs and working really hard to, you know, start that that community of midwifery research. We do have a research unit at McMaster University.
Yep.
In Hamilton, Ontario, which is very exciting. It's our first midwifery research unit in the country.
Oh.
Yes. Yeah. So that, you know, it's coming, but we just haven't made it to actually have a graduate program yet.
McMaster's have got a good reputation as well. And your kind of practices with birthing on country for Indigenous mm-hmm. cultures is actually part of leading the world with helping Indigenous cultures. So it seems really weird that the recognition is still very new, though midwifery's been happening, as we know, since kind of like the dawn of time.
Yes.
But so how much help or hindrance does, or is it not, with America's situation? Like, are you able to use some of the supports that they've got within their graduate, or are they kind of looking the same? Because we want to, obviously, there's a lot with Australia, New Zealand, and the UK and European midwifery, but we don't hear as much in the general kind of talking from a lot of the other countries, which is why this podcast is hopefully going to allow other countries to have their voices to share information.
Well, I mean, I hope that you're able to speak to some American midwives. I actually did complete my midwifery education at an American college because at the time I did it, we didn't have a program in Alberta yet. So I know a little bit about, and I hope I don't speak out of turn. I think midwifery, it's very different in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Not every state regulates it, so it varies quite a bit state by state. And then they have a number of different types of midwives there. There's the certified professional midwife, and then there's the certified nurse midwife. And I know some states have done state licensure for midwives and others haven't. But I think for the most part, I know there's some exceptions, you know, certified professional midwives really work out of hospital. And then of course, certified nurse midwives primarily in the hospital, although I know that there is some examples of crossover. So it's a very different context to here where, you know, there was, it was very political determining, you know, what the scope of practice for midwives would be in Canada. And of course, it is also provincially regulated. All of healthcare is provincially regulated here. But that there would be one type of midwife, that it would be distinct from nursing, and that we would work in all settings, I think was a very different trajectory than what we saw in the US. I think they've got some great things with their nurse midwifery there. But I think they also have some significant challenges in that, you know, that sort of ideological divide between out of hospital birth and normal birth and in hospital and medicalized birth has really manifested in two different types of midwives. I mean, that to me is sort of the most profound example you could have of that of that, those differing paradigms, is that we've actually assigned midwives to different settings in the US. So, and of course, they have other challenges. You know, we have socialized, well, essentially socialized medicine in Canada, or we have universal insurance here, which also makes a difference compared to the US, you know, that really lacks that universal healthcare. Very different context.
Yeah, their healthcare system astounds me, absolutely astounds me when you look at what it could be. And I think Canadians and Australians are very similar in a lot of ways, with, I think, kind of not only the kind of sense of humour, but also with kind of structures and especially with our healthcare. So that helps, but America is confusing to try and understand. And when you see the inequities, and I think that that's one thing that COVID has shown internationally, is that not just the health inequities, but where society inequities are breaching with casualization of work and kind of not having shelters and support, that's where we are kind of needing to improve. And that's a broader context than what midwifery is. So your supervisor, so you managed to pick a good supervisor for your, or were you assigned a supervisor for your master's and then you managed to have a good relationship with them?
I was assigned for my master's, and then for my professional doctorate, I approached her and said, this is what I'd like to look at, and would you be willing to supervise me? And luckily she said yes.
So was your master's a coursework, or did it have a thesis component to it?
It had a thesis component. So I actually did a mixed method systematic review of transfers from out of hospital birth locations in higher resource settings with like universal healthcare or single payer insurance systems. I wanted it to be as comparable as possible. And so I looked at variations in the transfer rate, and then factors that contribute to what is a very wide variation mm-hmm. in transfer rates across what should be very comparable settings. So, you know, jurisdictions with regulated midwifery, you know, accepted out of hospital birth, single payer or universal healthcare system, high resource settings, why do we see, you know, a variation from, some practices had like a 5% transfer rate, you know, and then others areas would be like a 50% transfer rate. And, you know, we know that in that setting, the people who are giving birth should be fairly comparable because it's a comparable social and economic setting. And so why the variation? So it's very interesting. We looked at lots of factors, clinical decision-making, geography, the role of practice guidelines, you know, experience of the individual practitioner. That's really interesting work. Yeah.
So did you end up publishing that?
I have not yet. No.
Yeah. We need to share. How can we share your results? Publishing is, it's academic, it's publish or perish, and it is a very hard process to go through with the journals, and especially with the increasing predatory journals. And with conferences, you've got posters, which I think are a very poorly used resource, because yes. posters can disseminate information, which is what we want. And they're the first step to kind of being able to sit there and somebody read that this is what I've done and this is what the results are. So you get your information, you can start those conversations. Whereas getting it published, and we need more and more open sources so that it's not hidden behind kind of paywalls, so that people can go, oh, this has been really interesting. Oh, I could do that. Oh, that actually affects me and I can actually change my practice. And I think that's one of the biggest things I've missed with conferences, in not going to conferences in 2020. Well, physical conferences, I've been to an awful lot of virtual ones, is
yes.
the conversation that you have over that cold cup of coffee, that you kind of go up to someone and say, oh, can you tell me a bit more, or start that email conversation later on. And I think that's something we need to improve on, is how do we disseminate? How do we kind of not necessarily work outside the journals, but how do we share the information that still kind of gets out? Because all these little projects masters and PhDs are not little projects, but they're important information that needs to be shared as well.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. And I think also, The other thing that's really struck me, particularly this year, and when you asked, you know, how have you kind of coped or managed during the pandemic, I think is that there's a structural issue with universities and our workloads and expectations for performance and production that make it really challenging. Mm-hmm. At least that's one of the things I've wrestled with this year is sort of, you know, what are reasonable expectations? What can you produce particularly under, you know, the kind of circumstances we've been over the last year, and building that back into academic life, which I feel like is potentially eroding.
finding that work-life balance anywhere is, I think, kind of a dream for a lot, but especially in academia. There's more and more asked for, and it's that being innovative, especially teaching online, trying to be innovative and not having the time to test it to see if it works, but then getting the feedback to it and then sharing that and saying, look, I tried this and this didn't work. Because we're also afraid to talk about failures.
Yes.
About when, okay, I tried this, but this didn't work. However, this part did, or somebody, and those brainstorming and having that collegial opportunity, which I think Twitter and hopefully kind of the Twitter handles with PhD Midwives and the monthly sessions that we're going to have online with that allows that conversation to have, or people can have spontaneous conversations and kind of go cup of coffee time and have people in different time zones kind of having at different breaks to share and do some of that spontaneous kind of things that could spout some amazing research or changes or collaborations.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So important.
So technology can be an advantage to us. It's just going to
work. Well, and I feel like I want to have my own podcast so I can interview you because I read your bio on the university page before our interview, and I was like, well, she sounds super interesting. I'm like, I want to ask her about the simulation, and I want to ask her how she does this.
I think that's the thing, is we forget what we do, and I kind of go, well, that's just my normal job. It's not very interesting until you kind of read somebody else's.
Super interesting. I'm very curious about simulation and how we use that effectively, and low and high fidelity simulation, and you know, using simulation at a distance, of course, because that's been one of the things that we've really had to deal with this year with the movement to virtual education or online, is how do you teach those hands-on skills to students who may be in another community?
And that's where looking at the resources, like with technology kind of coming through within the next 5 years, the haptic gloves are going to be developed enough that you're going to be able to use them to do the dexterity skills that are needing to be done with just a virtual headset. Doesn't need to be one of the big ones, expensive. It'll come down in price for a heads mounted device. And then that with the haptic glove means we can do, instead of the pinching, which kind of doesn't really give that realistic, we can do practicing VEs. We can have the tension against it. There are some dynamic haptic devices that have come out. Monash University have done one to do with abdominal palpations. Mm-hmm. And I know that in America they were trialing a VR version of indwelling catheters insertion. But it was still very much kind of like with the clicks, and you've got to click the device and pick it up. So as technology is improving, we're going to have a lot more opportunities. But then we've got to also think about, well, what are we trying to learn? And, yes, that's some muscle skills. They can do some of those developments and then come in and we can make sure the techniques are okay. But then it's that communication skill, and that's where I'm coming from, is how do we look at the non-verbal, verbal communication, and how's professional communication changed, especially with COVID. So that's where my PhD is looking at as well. So, yeah, simulation is a really good tool if used properly, and it's more than just a mannequin. So a lot of mm-hmm. people think simulation is only a mannequin, whereas simulation is a methodology and a mannequin is a model and method within that kind of like over methodology. And role-playing kind of cardboard cutouts on a table is all simulation. So you can do a lot of that stuff distantly, but it takes a lot of innovation. It takes a lot of thinking about what your learning objectives are. And now we've gone right off the topic and off onto my topic and not yours.
No, but that's interesting now for me. I've talked my topic to death.
I can talk simulation until the cows come home. I've kind of an innovation and all that stuff, because that's kind of obviously one of my pet passions for the last few years. Well, is there anything else, and is there any advice or anything that you have been told or you've experienced that would be of benefit to other people thinking about starting their PhDs?
I would say go for it. You have most likely more to contribute than you ever think that you do. And that's the first thing. And I think the second thing is that you are also a learner when you're doing doctoral studies. And I think it's really easy to feel like you have to perform and you want to do very well and that you should know it all already. And that's just not the case. You're learning a whole skill set. And so it's okay to set really reasonable expectations for yourself. And I always think my supervisor is Sue Down, actually. And And so, you know, sometimes we'd have these amazing, you know, discussions, but I'd come out and I'd think like, God, I just feel so kind of stupid. Yep, right? Yep, yep. And I'm like, yeah, because it's Sue Down. And I'm lucky to get to learn from her.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. I'd say I can walk out of my supervision sessions and kind of go, oh, I'm glad I recorded that, because I need to go back and listen to that again, because I was just carried away when they're chatting and I'm just sitting there kind of feeling, oh, my God, I know nothing. I have no idea what they're talking about.
I know. I'm trying to remember one day she corrected me. I said something about like, oh, I think this is an example of like complexity theory or this, and she's like, I think you just mean it's complex. I was like, and then I thought, you know what, it's okay. So that would be my advice, go for it anyway.
And that's the important, and I've talked probably a couple of times about the importance of the supervision relationship, and I'm probably going to keep on talking about it because it is so critical. But having that, being able to feel that comfortable with admitting that you don't know anything or that you're confused is really important, because it is all about that learning. It's like, have I understood this the right way? No, yes, or, oh, I was thinking of this. Okay, I'm using the wrong words, but this is what I'm thinking of. Oh, so you're meaning that. And then kind of allowing that free-forming to occur.
Absolutely. And just that you get the opportunity to learn from someone who's had a lot more time to study all kinds of things that are out there, right? And that's the joy of it, is that you get access to that and somebody to give you all of the different, you know, books to read and authors and concepts that you haven't had an opportunity to learn yet. And that's just a huge joy. Yeah, so I would say go for it, and it's okay to be a learner.
And what the fun thing is that in probably about 5-10 years' time, there'll be people saying the same thing about you as you're helping them.
We can only hope.
And that's that. Pass it on, pass it forward. Thank you so much for giving me your time today.
Thank you. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed our chat, and I can't wait to listen to all the future episodes of Through the Pinard.
Thank you.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM. Thank you.